This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Howard Norman is known for fiction set in the Canadian Maritimes. He's been a National Book Award finalist twice, and he's made Vermont at least his part-time home for decades. He and his wife, the poet Jane Shore, live in a farmhouse in Calais, and that's where he has set his new novel, The Ghost Clause. Norman says it will be his last novel, though not his last book. And so it is filled with references to the people he knows and loves in Vermont. And it very descriptively details Norman's actual house, particularly the library, where the ghost of the Ghost Clause likes to spend his time. I went to visit Howard Norman at his home to talk about the new novel. There on the desk in the library was a very thick, heavy book, The Collected Works of Wallace Stevens. In the novel, the book at one point sort of flies around the room and lands on the floor, thrown there by the ghost. The ghost narrator, Simon, keeps setting off the alarm system in the house, and the new homeowners just cannot figure out what's going on. In the real-life library, this exact type of incident gave Howard Norman the spark of an idea.
The rest of the house was fine, and the motion in library alarm kept coming off, and these guys would come out from Montpelier and check everything and say, we can't figure out what's going on. And one day, a fellow said, he looked at this thick collected poems of Wallace Stevens, and he said, that book would have to fly around the room and fly to the ground and hit the alarm under the rug for that to go off. There's something wrong with this system. And that's when I thought, I'm going to write a book in ghost first person.
Even though it's called The Ghost Clause, even though on the back flap you can see that it's going to be a situation where there's somebody who is not currently living, it's a little bit unnerving when you start see that first eye in the narration. And then you realize not only is the narrator a ghost first-person narrator, but he's actually in the bathroom with the current couple who's inhabiting this house, and he's watching them. He's watching the husband draw a bath for his wife, and he's watching her get in, and there's something unnervingly voyeuristic about it when that first moment appears.
I was very aware of this, Jane, and wanting to figure out as early as I could a way to refine that sense of voyeurism, if you will. And the way I figured to do that after five or six drafts was to make him self-consciously aware of what he was doing and start to move away from that and to be almost startled that he was drawn to certain intimate moments, obviously projecting from his own feeling of loss that he couldn't participate in these intimate things with his own wife. But I think it's, you know, not so far into the book where he realizes it. And I was glad. I don't think I could have written this novel if it didn't work that way, because I think it would have been a little creepy, and I didn't want that. I wanted it to be about the interaction of two marriages, a duet between a former marriage and a present marriage, and he to be the kind of narrative composer of that duet, if you will.
Will you tell us a little bit about him? His name is Simon Inniscourt, and he was 48 when he died. He had a heart attack aboard a ship headed toward Nova Scotia. He was a writer, and he was married to Lorca Pell, who is a painter, and they lived in this house, which Lorca then sold after Simon's death to the next couple who become these very large characters in the book. Tell us a little bit about Simon and Lorca, and then Muriel and Zachary, the very much alive couple living in the house now.
This is about a man who is a habitual writer, and he's keeping what in effect is a diary about the new couple that's moved in. She's a scholar of Japanese poetry. He is a private detective, and that leads to the missing child case that is central to the traditional plot. So everything that happens over a couple-year period of time, he chronicles and hides these notebooks until his wife tells him, what are you doing? You think you're doing something on this young couple's behalf, but actually, what do you think they will think when they find this? And it never occurred to him.
I'm interested that you're willing to tell this part of the story because it comes so late in the book. I didn't know if you would want it, if you would think of it as too much of a spoiler, but it's so interesting because throughout the book, there are hints that there may be somebody who's inhabiting this house. But it's not until the very end that the new couple has any suspicion that maybe Simon and his court is still here.
I would say if a novel has a well-integrated story, one shouldn't worry about spoiler alerts because there's no one moment that reveals the essence of the story. If it was a police procedural, if there was a surprise ending or something that happened that would have tied all the loose ends together, then one would worry. But my hope is that a reader might feel that on almost every page, there is at least, if not something that's a revelation, then the story keeps opening up and keeps opening up and keeps opening up to the very end.
You have a line in the book that I've written down because it's one of my favorites. You say, in my life in Vermont, everything I loved most happened most every day. And I pulled that right out because it was so true of how I see Vermont as well. But there's this celebration of village life, of small town living, of getting to know your neighbors, whether you like them or not. They sort of become family that you're so clearly celebrating in this book.
I wouldn't mind this book being seen as a love letter to a place, to a house. I hope it does not strike that its deepest chords are not sentimental ones. I had written an essay once in a series of essays referring to that idea that everything one loves happens almost every day, but almost every day, not necessarily every day. I wanted that atmosphere to permeate this novel. And I also wanted to have it where every day being a bold act of the imagination, they had to figure out how to get through these days. And part of the way you get through a day is just by talking to somebody about it. So you have this case of a missing child in Adamant, and every day there are false leads. And I suppose I wanted that to be the working metaphor. Is you're drawn in one direction, and you keep getting drawn in the wrong direction, in the wrong direction, until the right direction reveals itself. And I kind of wanted that to be central to this whole novel.
The other thing that's happening in this book that is this love letter to a place and to a building is that actual real people are filtered throughout. And one of the central characters, VPR listeners will know, is Erica Heilman, who is a private detective in the novel and very involved in this missing child case. So Erica Heilman, by name, is a character in this book. Ann Cummings, Senator Ann Cummings, is Montpelier's mayor in the book. And you've sprinkled through other names of people who you know and care about and love in these communities. So Rick Winston, who people will know in Montpelier from the Savoy, Ed Koren, the cartoonist. And I'm happy to note even Vermont Edition gets name dropped. Although I will say, Howard, the book is set in 94, 95, and we weren't around at that point, but I'll forgive you that transgression.
It's license. Part of the love letter is you get to combine your favorite things from different eras. That's what Virginia Woolf called fictional alchemy. And I struggled with it a little bit. But finally, since all the characters based on people that I actually know are treated well and behave well, and they comport themselves with the actual dignity in which they comport themselves in real life, then I worried about it a little less. And also, I didn't want to be coy. So I just thought I would say who people were, especially because I put my own, or at least the narrator's own, funeral in this book. And I wanted all the people that I love most to come to the funeral, not because I wanted the attention, but because I wanted the sense that they had lived longer than I did.
So are you worried about your own mortality? I mean, you are writing a book about a character who's very much like yourself in some ways, who's living in the house that you currently actually live in, who is a writer, who writes about Nova Scotia. And you've told me you're planning for this to be your very last novel.
Yeah.
So are you a little obsessed with mortality?
One of my favorite quotes is from a Japanese writer, Aku Tagawa. And he wrote, "What good is intelligence if you cannot locate a useful melancholy?" And I think it was more about constructing a melancholic atmosphere rather than the lugubriousness of thinking about mortality and the self-indulgence of that.
One of the neat things you get to do in this book that I really loved and I'm so curious about is the poetry that one of the characters is studying. So Muriel, who's part of one half of this young couple who have moved into Simon and Lorca's house, is a scholar, and her particular area of focus is on a Japanese poet's work. The way these poems work is there's a poem that is unto itself a full poem, a fully fledged poem, and many of these are sort of based on descriptions of landscapes or descriptions of the natural world. And then within the poem, there is a line in parentheses that is very intimate, usually sexual, takes a very different turn and can be pulled out of the poem and read by itself, but is also supposed to inform the poem. I found these poems within the novel fascinating and beautiful. And I'm wondering how you came to this concept within the novel.
Well, first of all, thank you, because, of course, that poet does not exist, nor does, as far as I know, and I asked a very dear friend named Jim Ulek, who's a curator at the Freer Sackler Asian Gallery in Washington, if he knew of any form like that, because I'd wanted to create something different. I was very interested in a story within a story, so you have one narration going on, and then the parentheses, I wanted to be an erotic incident, a moment in which the reader needs to change his or her attentions and then work their way back to the end of the poem again. Because I saw that finally as how we live life, or how I wanted these characters to live life, that you're going along in your life and suddenly life intervenes. And something else, whether it's erotic or sad or joyful, not ambushes you, but surprises you and requires all of your attentions. And then you have to work your way back to your life again. Anyway, that's how I experience life, and I don't know if anyone else does.
Late in the book, very late, Simon writes about the things that he's going to miss, because he talks in the novel about how what he's experiencing, he is dead, he knows he's dead. And he says this is sort of the ongoingness, is how I think he phrases it, that he doesn't know quite what's going on. But he says, at some point, I think I'm going to sort of disappear. I'm going to cease to exist, sort of. And he writes, besides missing his wife, I will also miss seeing a fox loping boldly down the snowy dirt road, or the way a crow, as it crosses the wide field behind the farmhouse, hardly flapping a wing, indicates the updrafts. Are those the things that you think you'll miss when you cease to exist?
Yes. I think it's a very short list. I think that, of course, there's certain people with age, perhaps you start to recognize that old phrase, a nostalgia for the present. And I think when you lose friends, it's no big surprise that you start thinking about these things. But sometimes I'll see something, especially out the window or a certain ornithological moment or something like that. And I'll think, you should recognize the fact that you're only going to see this once. And that's the kind of thing you would miss.
Both of the lines that I quoted, the line that Simon says, where the things I love most in Vermont are things that happen mostly every day, and the list of the things that he will miss, this one crystallized moment where you see something, I think they go well together, even though, yes, you may only see that one fox cross that snowy field once. It's not a moment that changes your life. It's just a simple, quiet moment, often things that you experience by yourself or that you recognize by yourself. But those are the moments that make up a life, and I appreciate in this book that you, through your narrator, Simon, point out that these are the things that we miss the most, or would miss the most, or think we'll miss the most about our lives, because they distill down to that simple joy of being alive.
I'm a person who goes on rounds after writing in the morning. Say, I'll drive, and I'll take these drives, and they're rounds. I stop in and see a friend, go to a bakery, go look at kingfishers, whatever it is, you become a kind of docent of your own life, and you're guiding yourself to this place and that place. And I have these rounds, and there's variations on them. But the deeper variation is that no 2 days are the same. They can't be, by definition. So the nuances of daily life seem to reside in these slight differences. that let you know you're alive and you are alert to these things. I don't think it's a big philosophical disquisition. I think it's purely experiential. And those things are deeply celebratory to me.
Howard Norman's new novel is called The Ghost Clause. There's a reading and book launch tomorrow, July 2nd at 7 p.m. at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier.